Well, my name is John Lillis, and currently I'm the dean at Bethel Seminary in San Diego. And before I came back to the States to be involved in both teaching and administration, theological education, I spent most of the 80s in Southeast Asia involved in theological education, and there gained my cross-cultural experience, and we were actually dealing with students in about 8 different Asian countries. So a lot of my illustrations are going to come from that context, and I just wanted to say that up front. I'm really new to Europe, because even having come back from Asia, when I do go overseas, I have the dollars, I typically go over there. So I'm excited to be here. I've been very excited about the sessions and then the network. I'm in the Leadership and Education Network, and Nick spoke to us this morning, and it was just fascinating. We also had some discussion among ourselves about the problem. Our topic this afternoon is leadership development programs that fit. You've got a handout that's rather extensive, so before you panic, I don't plan to talk about every word that's on that handout. I want it to leave you with something that you could take from here and utilize in your situations, and almost a manual standpoint, or from a manual. And I will be talking, I'll be referencing everything that's on there, but not necessarily talking about everything that's there. About 4 years ago, I was approached by an individual in Grand Rapids, Michigan, who was helping a Bible college in an Asian country. I won't mention the country right now. And they had made connections with him, and he basically was providing some funds for them, and they had just revised their curriculum, and he knew that my background was in curriculum development, and wanted me to look at it to see what I thought. And it was 4-year Bible college. And as I looked at it, it was very clear that they had looked at at least one, if not more, catalogs, probably that he had supplied, of Bible colleges in the U.S. And the curriculum was a synthesis of those. I could probably even pick the Bible colleges if I worked hard at it. And I happen to know this particular area in Asia, knew the problems, the challenges, the culture that they were facing, and there was absolutely nothing in that curriculum that was going to help them with what I'd call real-life ministry, that was going to meet the needs of the situation. I put together about a 5-page document that indicated that, and it got filed, and that was the last I was contacted over the situation. There's another phenomenon that we're seeing that I've seen in the last 20 years in my involvement in theological education and leadership development, ministry preparation, and that's the desire to look back in history and find a particular model. I know in the States, one of the models that have been popular or people have talked about is the apprenticeship model. That we used, that churches in the States used in the late 1700s, early 1800s, and said, that's what we need to do. We need to just train leaders that way. Well, when you go, or they go back to another period in church history, or go back to the first century, and we need to do it that way. Well, in each of those situations, we're ignoring the fact that there is a particular situational context that those methods worked for, that often those methods arose naturally from, that may or may not be congruent with our situational context. And so what I want to do today is to talk about that a bit, talk about constructing, developing ministry preparation programs, leadership development programs that fit the situation. Now, what we're going to do, the outline that you have on your handouts there, some introductory comments, but it's really going to be a bit more than introduction. I'm going to begin to get into it a bit, an overview, a rationale. Then understanding the situation is the heart of the methodology. I want to talk a little bit about purpose and method, or as well, you've probably heard, form versus function, and then categories for analysis. And then finally, as time permits, your situations, although the idea here is with your situation is then taking what we've talked about and applying it to your situation. Feel free, the venue here is small enough, feel free to interject, ask questions, make comments at any time. Just don't expect me to acknowledge them. No, I'm kidding. We'll interact as you desire. So let's look at the first here, the overview. And there's some things that I want to point out that we need to realize that the present system, and you have this as number one there under whatever, what is that? Are we at Roman numeral one, letter A, something like that? Just to track. We need to realize that the present system of resident specialized schools of ministerial training is a fairly recent phenomenon when you look at the history of the church. That the church hasn't always prepared leaders depending primarily on this type of delivery system. Now, it's been interesting to me, for those of you that were in the Leadership Education Network this morning, in the group discussions that we had, as well as Nikolai's discussion, the frustrations, the tensions, the challenges that we all sense with our present systems of formal education. Having said that, I think we also need to realize that there's enough cultural and social inertia in terms of expectations of what is valid preparation, that that's not going to go away. And that we're going to need to be working at least partly, if not wholly, within that system. And we'll talk a bit more about that. For those of you that signed up for it, this workshop I'm doing tomorrow, we're actually going to look at a model that combines formal education, non-formal education, as well as on-the-job training, the local church, in terms of a total system for leadership preparation and how we might integrate those. Another thing that we want to do in this session is that I want to demonstrate some of the cultural and situational forces which resulted in the forms of leadership training that we observe throughout the history of the church. And that's when we get to that categories of analysis. We'll talk about those. And then finally, we need to be aware, at least, of the situation and the assumptions that underlie the current Western approach to theological education. Because just like I was talking about in terms of historical eras, where people want to go back and take this method and that method, just like that there are situational assumptions underlying those methods, so it is with the Western model that determine its relative fit. Now, I have some personal feelings that the assumptions that underlie the Western model no longer fit the situation in the Western world either. But that's another discussion that we could have. So, in terms of rationale, just a few things that we, you know, why we're doing this particular session, why we're going to talk about what we're going to be talking about, why we need categories for analysis, if you would, is that, first of all, we need to realize as part of this rationale, and again, for those that were in the network this morning, Nikolai pointed it out, as did some others in the various discussion groups, is that most theological education today is modeled in some fashion after the form of Western theological education. Ultimately, we can trace it back to the German-English paradigm of university education, and that's been exported via American types of adaptations to many places in the world today as well. Asia especially, we see the American adaptations, and I think that the German-English model has been modified in places in Europe and other parts of the world as well, having been cycled through the American filter. So that model has some things that we need to be aware of. there are assumptions, and it assumes various teaching means and methods. It has particular curriculum and delivery system, a particular philosophy of education, as well as educational objectives that are all intended for that context, that situational context. So that's something we need to be aware of. The Western model also for theological education came about. Yes?
Can I have to go back just one
minute? Sure.
Could we add another one to that now? Because there is something dramatically changing in the world today that adds to your list.
Okay.
An adequate assessment model.
Okay.
Would you agree with that?
Oh, indeed.
Yeah,
for those
accrediting rooms and so forth have now moved into a new phase.
Yeah. For those of you that aren't blessed / cursed with the joy of doing higher education in the United States, this has become the primary concern in the States, especially in higher education. Whether it's theological education, whether it's liberal arts education, whether it's elementary education, secondary education, anything is assessment. And it's shaping how people do education. Yeah, that's an excellent point here. And you're right, it's a fifth point that shapes everything else. Entire curricula are being recast in order to reflect the assessment. Thanks. And often then, the methodology is exported or imported without that awareness. So we need to be aware of that. Thanks, Gary. As I've indicated, the Western model has specific setting and needs. There are definite ideas and beliefs about what is a church leader, what is the role of a leader, what education is demanded, and what constitutes a proper education. Some of those are biblically based, in part, but all of those in part and some of them in whole are more culturally influenced, contextually influenced than they are biblically. And we need to be aware of that. That impacts the leadership preparation, the schooling, the educational system, our ideas about that. It's been interesting in just the day and a half that we've been here, I've been listening to people talk about what is a leader. And again, in our network this morning, Nikolai was talking about the impact in Eastern Europe, especially, of the authoritarian models of leadership as those have been brought into the church. And we often aren't aware of that, but we bring our presuppositions, our assumptions, our preconceptions about what leadership is into a given situation. And so it is with the Western model that everybody has exported. So we need to be aware that there are present within the society certain cultural and sociological conditions which permit it the form that theological education took and became, as you see in your notes there, what we know as theological education in the West today. So what we want to do is provide enough information to allow people, any of you, to compare your current situation, your present situation, to that which gave rise to the Western education or to any other educational system used as a model. This is part of what we're intending to do with the model, the system that I want to develop in the next point, is to be able to compare systems, whether it's to the Western theological model or going back and looking at something in history and seeing, would this fit our situation? And it's also intended to provide some insight into how those types of forces have shaped the form that theological education has taken throughout the history of the church. An interesting thing I've been working on for about the last 10, 15 years is taking the model and just looking at various periods in history and say, okay, here's what they did. Now, using these categories of analysis, what was underlying it? what arose naturally from the culture? What were they doing that was modeled after something else that doesn't fit the culture or is coming from a prior age? What needs to be changed? And it's been a fascinating study and something I would recommend that you do, because there's a lot that we do that's based upon something that we've always done, at least for 200 or 300 years in education, that came out of another situational context that no longer fits our situational context. So let's now go to, as I said, the heart of things, the core of things, and talk about the situation. How do we understand the situational context? implicit in what I've been saying thus far is the tension that exists between what we call form and function, purpose and method. And so we need to look at that first. What is the purpose? What's the purpose of what we're doing? Well, the purpose, obviously, is to train and develop leadership for the church. And I realize that in educational circles, there's a debate and not a little controversy about whether train is the word we want to use, educate is the word we want to use, prepare is the word we want to use. I don't want to get into that debate. So if you want to mark through anything and put your own words, that's fine. To train and develop leadership for the church, it's a function that's rooted in Scripture. The purpose is to train and develop leadership for the church. It's a function which must be fulfilled, a function which goes right back to Scripture. But we need to realize that even in the first century, even in the New Testament times, the particular method or form that they used arose from and therefore fit the situation of the first century. It was actually applying the model to biblical times that got me interested in the whole flow of history. Because as I was teaching in Asia, we had students that were both expat missionaries as well as Asians from a variety of countries. And our expatriate missionaries came from all over the world. And everybody was saying, well, let's go back and do it the way they did it in the New Testament. And I mean, there are some principles certainly to be derived from that. Jesus walked with the 12. Well, Jesus also, as did others in that first century, didn't have to worry about the biblical languages. Theology was, at least as we know it today, there was not 2,000 years of church history in which the various issues and controversies and heresies had arisen. So it was a different situation. And the methodology that was used, the form that was used, fit that situation. Now, I'm not saying that aspects of that wouldn't fit the current situation, but we need to realize that. So throughout the history of the church, from the first century on, this very basic and necessary purpose of training and developing church leadership has been accomplished through a variety of methods or forms. We need to be careful to differentiate between function and form, purpose and methodology. Sometimes we equate the two, or sometimes we confuse the two, so that form becomes equated with function, that methodology replaces the purpose. And then the means become the end, as it were. So just for clarification, the function, the purpose, is the basic end which theological education is to accomplish. That first thing we had there, that's to train and prepare leaders for the church. That's what we mean by function or purpose. Now, function and purpose aren't true synonyms, all right? But I'm using them in an analogous way here. And form or method refers to the specific manner or the approach used. And so one of my key theses here is that the function that we want to accomplish the purpose, the goal in mind, is been the same throughout the ages. The method or the form, however, to accomplish that function, to complete that purpose, has depended or ought to vary with the situational context. Gary.
Just another thought. Did you say that part of the challenge that people are dealing with today is that they get things reversed, that they think that form ought not to follow function. Function follows form rather than the other way around.
Well, that's,
if you don't start with the purpose and you start with the method.
In fact, that's another nice word we have for that's institutionalism. And that's exactly what happens. You start institutions. We can call them schools, seminaries, colleges, universities, and they become the end in themselves. The form begins to dictate the function. No, I think that's exactly what's happened. This is one way, I think, of articulating the frustration, the tension that we feel in this whole thing of leadership development, is this whole form versus function debate and controversy. Forms, and this is just saying just the opposite of what you said, forms must be functional. That is, they must accomplish the intended purpose. And that purpose is to meet the church's leadership needs. I think, at least in the States, one of the biggest problems that we have today is that many of our seminaries have become ends in themselves. You talk to seminary faculty and say, what is it you do? And they don't say things like, I am involved at so-and-so seminary preparing leaders for the Church of Jesus Christ. They say things like, I'm an Old Testament scholar, I'm a theologian, I'm a New Testament scholar who works at XYZ Seminary. So that their particular area, their particular discipline and scholarship in that has become an end in itself. Now, I'm not saying that scholarship in these disciplines is not important. The church needs scholars. I'm not saying that at all. But we also need leaders. Again, and I apologize for those of you that weren't in the network, but Nikolai's talk just so impacted me, and it's fresh on my mind. But he was talking about in seminaries in Eastern Europe that he's been involved with, about how the theses that students have to write their senior year are just irrelevant. They don't have anything to do with the ministry that the students are going to participate. I think, if I can remember his quote, who cares why Luther wrote a particular thing when he wrote it? And the implication is not that he's not saying it's not important that Luther wrote it, that we understand it, but he's talking about those finer detailed studies, why did Luther write this? What were the various things and so forth? Well, in limited areas, that is important, but not as a senior thesis for students that are going out to prepare for local church ministry, necessarily, was his point. So we have this where, as you've said, the forms began to define the function rather than derive from the function. One of the things that I'd like to point out, and this would be item number 4 there, is that there is no one method or form of theological education or ministry preparation that is scripturally preferred over another. Now, that's my opinion on this. If you differ, that's fine. Then you could do a workshop and tell people what you think. But I don't think we get that in Scripture. The biblical mandate is to prepare leaders. There is, I don't think, a particular method that's a scriptural absolute. It says, Paul was telling Timothy in 1 Timothy 2:2. Wake my mouse up there. You then, my son, be strong in the grace that is in Christ Jesus, and the things you have heard me say in the presence of many witnesses, and trust to reliable men who will also be qualified to teach others. One of the missionary epistles there in 1 Timothy Paul is telling Timothy what he needs to do in order to leave that work and come to him, move on. And the whole thing is to prepare leaders. And then a couple of the chapters there, chapters 2, 3, are an excellent outline for a curriculum for the situation in Ephesus. He's giving kind of a curriculum design, if you would, for leadership preparation for what Timothy was doing there, so that he could leave some faithful men in charge and move on. Establish the church there. So the mandate was, Timothy, prepare leaders. But he didn't tell him how. Yes, sir. Yes. Yes.
And I presume that's not what you intend.
Well, no. As a matter of fact, it could be. And when we get to categories of analysis, there's a set of questions that the particular church needs to ask itself. Okay. Oh, I see what you're talking about. Yes, yes.
So
yes, okay, I'm sorry.
Defined, and it leads for, but it's narrowly defined to
right.
Being the training of professional clergy. If you're
yes.
not in that category, then we won't train you. You know, we don't
create right.
forms to serve you. I mean, of course, it's changing, but you know, traditionally that's been the case.
Yes, now, there I think the school needs to step back and re-examine what it's looking at, because it might not be meeting the needs totally of the situation. And part of a couple of the categories we're actually going to look at for analysis address those things. The needs, the ministerial assumptions, as well as the ecclesiastical assumptions. Yeah, that's an excellent point. Excellent point. In fact, the seminary that I graduated from back in the late 70s would only accept students who were going at that point who were going into vocational ministry. And now they have changed over the last two decades so that they're preparing people who aren't necessarily going into vocational ministry as well. I wish I could say it was because they sat down in response to the church's needs, but I suspect it was more financially driven. It was survival. Okay. Let's talk now about the heart of the matter here, the categories for analysis, and what in the world am I talking about here? What in the world am I talking about analyzing a situation, categories for this analysis? Well, there's some questions that we want to answer with what I'm going to be doing here. Here I've been saying it's important to know what the situation is. It's important to come up with a form or a method that fits the situation. So how do we know that? How do we know what form or method fits the situation? What are the factors or the categories of factors that influence the situation, and in particular, influence the situation in a manner that is significant for the practice of leadership within the church and the preparation of those who are going to lead in the church? So what are the factors? What are the categories? And then another qualifier is that we need to realize that some factors are more important for given situations than others. And as a subpoint to this, there are other ways of categorizing the analysis. I, in a past life, used to be a theoretical physicist. In fact, came to the Lord when I was in that practice and had a lot of math. And in math, we describe various situations with certain base sets. And you can describe a given mathematical situation with different base sets. You're describing the same situation, but you can describe it differently depending upon the base set that you use. Well, I've picked a base set of categories. You could ask the same types of questions, glean the same information with a different base set. I'm more interested in getting you to think along these lines of analysis. Also, when I talk about these categories, again, there's nothing sacred about the categories, nor is there anything sacred about the questions. I'm giving them to you as a means of understanding the category as I'm defining it. I'm convinced that engagement in the process of this analysis is just as important, if not more important, than the particular categories, what you call them, particular questions that you ask. Because really what you're trying to do is to gain an understanding of a situation. So I'm giving you that qualifier. Again, there's nothing sacred about the list I'm going to give you. It's an illustration of how to do this kind of analysis. You might take it home and say, well, you know, two of these that he listed just don't relate to me at all, but they do suggest two others. Or I'd really rather take all of the categories and rename them this. That's fine. I suspect, again, that you'll be describing the same situation, gathering the same data I will. You'll just be organizing that data differently. So that's. Let me just give that up front so that we don't get locked into it. There are six categories. Now, over the next few minutes, we'll be going back and forth between that last point on your outline there and, if you'll flip over, the worksheet, okay? The situational analysis worksheet. And all I've done in the worksheet is to expand the category. In the outline, I've just given you a description of the category. In the worksheet, there are some sample questions that further flesh out what we're talking about looking at in the each category. So we've got, this session goes until 5:15. So we're in good shape. I hope we'd have about this much time when we were here. As we go through here, I'd like you to be thinking, and in each of the categories, I want to ask you what might be a particular aspect of this in your situation that would impact leadership development programs, theological education, or however you're doing them. So the first that we want to look at, sociological assumptions. We're basically here saying, what is the nature of the society to which the church is ministering? There are going to be things in each society that are different. And those differences are going to place different demands upon those who are going to lead in the church in one context versus another. As I've been listening in our small group today, I had in the small group I was in, we had three individuals who were pastors, church planters in Romania. And as I listened to them talk about what their biggest challenge was in discipling and mentoring people, it no surprise, struck me that the issues, many of the issues that they were facing were different than the issues I would face in doing the same task in the U.S. because of the society in which they live. There are just different things going on. And then that's going to require a little bit different approach to preparation for being a leader in that. Now, if you flip over to the worksheet, you just see a series of questions here. And again, these are kind of for example, to get us thinking. Now, let me say that I've put this together with the idea that you could apply it to any level of leadership development. I'm going to talk about it because this is my background. In terms of a school or in terms of designing programs at a national level or denominational level. But you can actually apply this at a local church level in terms of preparing lay leadership. And so I will try to use the word program versus school, because anything that we put together for preparing can apply at any level. Also, I should have said this earlier. Well, I think I did in the introduction. You can use this analysis two ways. You can use it to analyze an existing situation, whether it's in another culture or in another era in history, to analyze that to see how or why it came about and how congruent that situation is with your situation. Or you can use it in sitting down and planning leadership development for your situation. In either case, I strongly recommend that this is something which a group of people do. That it's not just something you sit down and write some answers to, although I'm not sure if I got rid of that in the worksheet or not. It's one of the problems with cutting and pasting from other sources. Earlier on, I left some things in your version when I was putting the outline together that was actually a note to me. So if you see little things like illustrate this with, or that's not for you. Don't worry about that. That was a note to me, and I left it in there. Now everybody's going to spend the next 5 minutes trying to find that. Fantastic pedagogical technique. Point out the errors in the handout. But I would recommend a group of people that are responsible for either doing the leadership development or planning the leadership development, overseeing it, whatever, to sit down and to think about. And the first step is use my worksheet as a beginning page and ask yourself, are these questions even legitimate for our situation? Or are they complete? Are there more questions we need to be asking ourselves? But things like, what is the social and economic status of the society in which the church is ministering? There's all kinds of things that go on there. If you're working on leadership development in India, for example, the whole social status thing is an important thing that you've got to at least be aware of. Now, it's not a... most Indian Christians that I know would say that the caste system, for example, is not a biblical thing, but it's a reality. It is a reality. And there are other Asian... Singapore, one of the things that just struck me every time I'm there is that you have a mixing pot of all the Asian cultures there. And I think there's things that you've got to be aware of. Is that a correct assessment? There, as you look at that society, one of the things you've got to say is that this is a society that consists of many, many different cultures. In fact, the government has said you're going to think about that with the white paper. Do you remember the white paper that came out back in the late 80s, early 90s that dealt with evangelism and so on? And so there's these factors that are going to impact how you do leadership development. Just some others. The third one, what is the average educational level of the group to which the church is ministering? This one bugs me. And in the States now, in graduate seminaries, this is a sign that the form has replaced the function. We all sit and we have these discussions about the dumbing down of the American population, and that the students that we're getting just aren't what they used to be. Therefore, we need to raise the admission standards. We need to cut out those that are... It's the thing I hate here is the 10-90 rule. We spend 90% of our time with 10% of the students. 90% of our time with those 10% that are just not as bright as the rest. So we need to raise the... And as the dean, they're always coming to me, John, we need to raise the admission standards. We need to jack up the... increase the GPA, increase the... make them take the GRE exam, da-da-da-da-da-da. And so I thought, now wait a minute. What are we about? What are we about? Are we a graduate school of theology, or are we preparing people for leadership in the church and we're doing it at the graduate level? I think those are entirely different. Now, yes, as long as you're going to give master's degrees, you've got to maintain an integrity there. But if we're beginning to make comments like I just said, then we're beginning to, I think, leave our basic purpose. And if we are, then we've got to define it. We've got to be honest about it. Because we're preparing people, or at least ostensibly that's what we're telling our supporters when we do the fundraising, that we're preparing people for ministry. So it's an important question. I've worked with some groups in Africa over the years, and this is an important question to ask, especially if they've been students of ours that have come over and gotten their master's or their PhD, and they're going back into an area where the highest education is eighth grade. Well, we need to know that. What is the educational level? What is the realistic educational level of the group to which the church is ministering? This also has implications in terms of the people in the church and how you're preparing leaders to minister to them. Yes, yes. Well,
it would be interesting to ask others from other cultures to what extent our assumption about merit is good, bad, or indifferent with respect to leadership development.
There's the thing you always throw in these lists, you know, is the qualifying thing at the bottom, other relevant factors or assumptions. There's one right there. What about your own situations, Gary? Or you? Oh, don't have their hand right now. We'll let you all think.
I had a question about the tension that I think we feel in the seminaries in the United States is when people from other cultures come to get our education, and then they go back to their culture. And so the only model they know is the one that we have crafted for use in training leaders in the United States.
Yep.
I mean, 40% of the people that are enrolled in Talbot Seminary now come from Korea.
Yep.
Has dramatically influenced the Korean population in the way in which they train leaders.
It goes back to my rationale there that the Western model is the paradigmatic, or is the paradigm for what's going on, and that's not necessarily so. As the rest of you have been looking just at this set, is there anything that strikes you as a key thing in your setting, or another question that needs to be asked from that? In the sociological setting. Let me point out that next to last question. How are all of these different factors relevant to your particular situation for developing church leadership? This is kind of a question that you need to ask after you've looked at the society. Because it's not intuitively obvious always. But I think that there is implication, there is relevance. And, I mean, I could see the group that's sitting down doing this analysis spending a significant amount of time just in this. You know, let's understand our society. Because this is the society for which we're preparing people to minister. This is the world that has shaped the flesh of those to whom we will be ministering and who will be coming into our preparation programs with the various baggage that all of that brings. Yeah.
Recent or past historical events have shaped society. Catholic, post-Catholic, Reformation, post-Reformation, atheistic versus now openness. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, wouldn't those be important?
Well, as a matter of fact, again, for those of you that were in the network this morning, Nikolai pointed specifically at 1989 and, you know, how that impacted the next decade. Let's go and look at the theological assumptions. Here, and again, you know, my labels, one of the hardest things I have to do is title sermons. You know, I always hate it when the church you're going to preach at calls you Wednesday and say, what's the title of your sermon? I've got the sermon, but it's the sermon on the passage. I don't have a title. So if the labels don't always fit, just forgive me. As I said, come up with a better one. But what are the unique situational needs of the church in terms of theological or cultural threats and or understandings? Here, what we're talking about primarily is the main other religion or religions or local culture which oppose Christianity in your particular situation. Now, I spent 3 years living in Thailand. And it's 96%+ Buddhist, 3%+ Muslim, and that's all in the southern part of the country, and less than 0.5% claim to be Christians. Well, Buddhism is a very significant factor there, which increases the irony of the Bible schools, the Bible colleges, the seminaries that have been formed based upon Western models. Because Buddhism has not been something that has shaped our curricula. This was one of the things I tried to point out to the individual that had contacted me about that particular Bible college. They didn't have one course in there that dealt with Buddhism. And that was the major other religion. It wasn't Thailand, okay? But it was the major other religion in this particular country. And there wasn't one thing there. So it's something that we need to ask ourselves. And it might be, in some places, it's not another religion, but it's the culture itself, a very humanistic culture. And there are aspects of that which stand in direct opposition to Christianity. And so we need to articulate that, need to spell that out. And I believe, like with all of these, it's something we need to do before we sit down and write the first course description. See, here's another thing. If those involved in the planning process immerse themselves in this kind of analysis over a period of time, then when they sit down and begin to talk about courses and curriculum, seminars, conferences, training programs, whatever, it's going to flow from a conscious awareness of the situational context. It's something we typically don't do. And that's why we read into the situation existing educational models. Here are specific doctrines which derive from the above mentioned religions or culture which represent an external threat to the integrity of the church. What false teachings resulting from the influence of the other religions or the local culture represent an internal threat to the church in the form of existing or potential heresies? That problem goes all the way back to the New Testament. Several of the epistles that Paul is writing, in those epistles, he's dealing with this kind of thing. The pre-Gnostic tendencies that came into the church, the Judaizing, the influences from the mysteries and the pagan religions that were impacting. Paul is addressing those issues there. And so we need to be consciously aware of that. What is the baggage that people are going to be bringing into the church and that students are going to be bringing into the seminary that will result in heresy? And then that next to last question always, well, so what? What's the significance of those issues, those threats for your programs of leadership development? What specific things will your program have to include because of these threats? There are cultural things. And again, this isn't just at the school level. You could be preparing leaders in the local church, and these questions are important. We run into a lot of the problems that we do in our implementation, in our enactment, in our living of Christianity because we don't ask these questions. People are coming in with baggage that they're not aware of and that we're not aware of. That's why Paul in Romans 12 said, "Don't be conformed to the world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind." The world is what shapes the flesh, and the mind is part of the flesh. So we're basically saying, what's out there that's going to be impacting people both within the church and within our leadership programs? It's important to know in the church so that the leaders we're preparing will know how to deal with that. I teach a course in spiritual formation at the seminary. And I spend probably a third of the time talking about something I call secular spirituality. One of the things that's happened in our postmodern world is that everyone is spiritual. For those that are of us that are 45 years old and older, we can remember the 50s and the 60s and the early 70s when if anybody used spiritual, then they were using it, you knew they were religious in some way. Today, everybody is spiritual. I've got a quote in the late 80s from Gorbachev when the Soviet Union was still in existence. And he was speaking at the Council of European Nations, I think. And he talked about how we all needed to give more attention to the spiritual dimensions of our lives. And I'll guarantee you, he wasn't using the word the same way you and I use the word. So we live in a culture, we live in a time in which everyone is spiritual. But we've got to understand what they mean from that, understand the culture. Any things that strike you from this, or questions we need to add, or in your situation? Are any of you from Eastern Europe? One, two, three. What countries are we have represented? Romania? Slovakia? Russia?
Ukraine.
Okay. I'm just curious. Is the theological threat, or is it mainly another religion, or is it the culture, the remnants from communism? And what do you think? Yes.
To deal with in theological terms. But the remaining of the communism is it's a threat for us to deal with.
Okay. And the church, yeah, and it was overt opposition, correct, at one point? Okay. You were going to say something.
Well, counting Ukraine, most population, they consider themselves as Orthodox believers. But in fact, they are like pagans because, well, they are open for new forms of pagans' influence and some cults, some demonic influences. Though they consider that they are believers, they are Orthodox believers because they are baptized in their chapel.
Okay.
It's a big problem.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, that helps me. Again, in Asia, you have some major other religions. Like to be Thai is to be Buddhist. It's just part of the warp and the woof of your culture. I have friends, dear friends, that are Thai Christians who, when they became Christians, if they were young people, they were thrown out of their homes. They were disowned. It takes you back to the first century, where there was risk and threat. So Buddhism was the key thing there. But then there are cultures that it sounds like there are other things that form the theological threat than another religion. But that impacts how we prepare leaders. We've got to do that. We've got to prepare leaders with a conscious awareness of those threats and how it impacts. Ecclesiastical assumptions. What did I just do? Hit the wrong key. Ecclesiastical assumptions, and this is getting to what you were talking about. What I thought you were talking about, okay? You weren't. But this is the question I answered first, the one you didn't ask. What is the character of the church, and what demands for leadership are being imposed by the group of churches, denomination, association, fellowship, whatever, that's being served? Now, there's an assumption implicit within this question, or within this description, and that is that there is a defined group of churches that the training program is servicing. There are places in the world today where we have schools where that relationship doesn't exist. And I don't think those schools are going to continue. I don't think they're going to succeed. They're going to fail. The assumption here is that if we're talking about a training program that's a formal training program, a school, seminary, something like that, it needs to have a clearly identified body of churches that it's serving. I don't know, maybe in your countries it's not the case, but there are places in Asia where various individuals have gone to the United States, got a seminary degree, then got a PhD, and then came back and started their school. And there's no clearly defined group of churches that they're servicing. So the questions here then relate to what are the leadership needs? And this, when you said professional ministry, I was thinking in another sense, from the high church to the low church type of thing. And we had this period in the United States where you had high church, where the idea of the minister as a professional, educated professional, versus the what people call the low church, the more free church, where that wasn't the case. And so there were different profiles there. This is an important first question. What is the purpose of the local church or group with which you are working? Why does it exist? What does it do for its members? What does it do for those outside of its membership? What does it see as its role in society? And you need to understand, we answer that question on two levels. We answer that question on the theoretical level. This is what we think it ought to be. And then we answer that question on the actual level. In my small group this morning, we had the three pastors from Romania, and then a person from Hungary, and they all four said that a key problem and challenge for them was that people didn't have the right priorities in terms of the church and the role that the church should play in their life. It was almost like you just described with the Orthodox Church. It was just, it's just something you do. And they don't have that biblical perspective of the church being central in their life.
And this is transferred from the Orthodox Church to the evangelical churches.
Right.
We are influenced by this way of being.
Now see, I think the place to address that is in the leadership development programs. Because often, the leaders we're preparing go with that same attitude. So you can say everything you want, but my real mission becomes to have three effective services a week. And if I can do that, and everybody's happy, then life is good. Okay? So we need to, in the leadership development programs, answer this on a biblical basis. What is the purpose of the local church? The church is the focus. Ephesians 4:11-16 describes how God has given the church pastors and teachers for the equipping of the saints, that the saints might do the work of the ministry, that the body of Christ might be built up. And then later, in verse 15 and 16, he talks about how the whole body is growing up into the head as each individual member does its part. Well, that picture pictures us together. You see, growing up in the family of God is something we do together or not at all. That's not the picture we have. The picture we have is, I have come to Christ, I have a relationship to God, and therefore the church is something I go to further that relationship with God. See, we've taken Ephesians 4:16 and we've said the following. Each individual member is growing into the head as the body does its part. We've turned that verse completely upside down. And it's because we don't understand the purpose of the local church. So, important question. So what are the leadership needs in terms of level and number at the present time? Often we go and start schools and we never ask this question. We start schools and we build structures to prepare hundreds of leaders, and when in fact we only need 10 or 20. Usually it's the other way. We start programs to prepare tens and twenties of leaders when in fact we need hundreds and thousands of different levels. And this is where we come back to what our brother from Singapore said. The church needs leaders at the vocational level, the full-time paid, but we need leaders at other levels. And we need training programs to develop those leaders. Other ideas or thoughts here? Yes, sir. Oh, yes.
The leaders have an overview of their purpose of the local church, and the members of the church, they have another one.
The gap. the great gap between. Yeah, that's... And that's not just a problem in Romania. That is a problem, I think, the world over. In the Western world, the problem results from the individualistic way we approach everything. And so the church is something totally different to the members and to those involved. Yeah. I would have loved to have seen the results of that survey. It'd be fascinating. Other comments here? Let's look at educational assumptions. This overlaps with what I talked about earlier, but here you're forcing yourself to answer that one question I had up in sociological assumptions. Now we're bringing it down and unpacking it. I think it's important that we do that. What level of education must the student already have? What knowledge is presupposed, and how is this provided? So just to unpack that, we need to ask ourselves, what's the minimum level of general education that potential leaders in the training program must have? And how's that provided? Going back to the issue I shared that we're facing in the United States with students just not as good as they used to be, the problem many people feel is with general public education. So we've got people coming into our training program. We need to understand the public education. And again, you might not like it, but it's reality. You've got to deal with it. You can't pretend that it's something that it's not, which is what we're in the danger, I think, of doing in the United States. We're basically going to just filter out everybody. What academic level will the leadership training be provided? Just because the seminary that I went to is at a graduate level, does a graduate level fit where I'm going? Where I'm teaching or where we're preparing. Does bachelor's level? Maybe we're doing it within the church. And maybe most of our church people that we're training only have high school. Well, if that's the case, then we need to be aware of that and do it that level. What prior knowledge are you assuming? Another problem that we're facing is... lack of biblical knowledge. Now, my seminary in San Diego is graduate level seminary, fully accredited. We've been around, well, we're a part of a larger campus in St. Paul. Bethel Seminary has been around over 100 years. And we're finding more and more students who know less and less about the Bible. And my New Testament professor was telling me last spring, he had an individual in one class, and they'd been studying one of the Gospels, and the student asked the question, said, "What is a Gentile?" Well, that's pretty basic information. And that's happening more and more. So we need to ask ourselves that question. What prior knowledge are we assuming? What prior knowledge can we assume? And how's that provided? Other things. Anything else strike your thinking here? Is this a significant factor? In most of your leadership programs, are they at the college level, the graduate level? What do you have? What? All or?
Yes, to me.
Yes, yeah. Okay. You have not? Okay. So what's your education? Okay.
And now I just start my education, my theological education. It's first course of correspondent course of seminary in that field.
Okay. Now, would your situation be similar to others that would be going into the pastoral leadership, that they would have university first, or?
I grew up, actually, when I was a young boy, it was time of persecution, and we had no opportunity to have education. But next generation of pastors, they had this opportunity.
Okay. Is it the opportunity, is it a graduate school? I mean, do you have to go to university before you go to the seminary?
Some of them, they prefer to have a
theological Okay. Yeah, and see, I'm thinking that in terms of the leadership needs for the church in Ukraine and other places, that it would be best to have the training program at not at the graduate level, but at the university level, or that you can enter out of high school. That's my thinking.
I think so.
Others, other comments? Ron, what are you doing in Portugal? Yours is non-formal, though, isn't it? But what are you assuming?
It's kind of a blend. We are assuming in a one-year training program, very little formal biblical training. We do, obviously, expect experience with Christ, and we want to know that people are wanting to grow in Christ, but what we do is put them into a ministry environment, namely with university students, learning language, culture, things of a foreign nature to them, because they're all internationals in Portugal doing this, and then together as a team doing evangelism. So we're in ministry, reaching out to students, so doing ministry, and at the same time learning, biblical content, ministry skills, hopefully character development. So it's very much a learning and doing approach.
Okay. But you're assuming some basic educational level.
Not necessarily. I mean, we've had them come straight out of high school.
Oh, so at least high school. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Okay. You need to realize, going to the Western model, the Masters of Divinity used to be the Bachelors of Divinity. But you didn't take the Bachelors of Divinity until you had done the Bachelor of Arts. And that had to do with belief, a belief system in the, in England, in the United States, and other Western countries, that first of all, you needed to learn how to think. And so that was the liberal arts education. And so everyone got a BA. If you look at some of the early German scientists, Einstein and some of the others, I think it was Heisenberg, the first math course he ever took was in graduate school, because he studied philosophy in his Bachelor of Arts. So the idea was that a proper education started with a Bachelor of Arts. And then you went into your profession. And so the Bachelor of Divinity was the first degree in divinity. So it was a bachelor's. It only became a Master's of Divinity because, at least in the States, people said, this is my second degree. You should at least give me a master's degree instead of a bachelor's. Same curriculum, they just made it a master's degree. My point is, there is nothing sacred about preparing people for ministry with a master's degree. Realize where it came from. It came from a sociological context in which there were certain ideas about what is valid education. Let me finish up here just very quickly. Economic, I did it again. behind her I get. Economic assumptions. This is so important. What is necessary to maintain the student in the program as far as finances? Who is going to provide this? And then, thus, what is being assumed concerning the student's abilities for support? In other words, how much is it going to cost to do it? How much is the student going to pick up? And then, where's the rest coming from? Graduate education is very expensive. I don't know of any seminary in the United States that is providing graduate level education where tuition pays for all of the education. It's subsidized somehow or the other. In some cases, the seminaries are associated with colleges, And the college students, we don't like to say this, but the tuition of the college students has helped paying for the education of the seminary students. In other places, it's through donors and so forth. So these questions, you need to ask yourself, what's the program going to cost? What are the various items for it? How is each item of expense to be met? Who's paying? What is being assumed about the student's ability to pay tuition costs? Sometimes we just don't ask those questions. We start programs, and then we spend, those in administration, spend the rest of their lives raising the funds for something that nobody can afford because we didn't think through the economic model, the economics. And what we did is we copied a program that they had over in this country where they had the financial means to do that program, and we don't, where the students could pay for it, and our students can't. You see, those economic assumptions. Finally, hit the right button. Ministerial requirements. What is the desired end product of the training program? And this depends upon the church or the churches to whom you're ministering. What is it they want? What is it they need as leaders? Again, this is where the school becomes an end in and of itself. The school is over here preparing people that aren't relevant for the ministries that they're engaged in. So, what areas and kinds of knowledge should trained leadership have? What specific skills should trained leaders be able to perform? What specific duties are required of the leadership which you're training? Need to ask that. And I think those questions need to be asked with some people from the churches in the room. What is it we want people to do? So let me leave you with this. What about your situation? Do the particulars of the situation, you've seen this five times now, right? Do the particulars of the situation warrant or justify the methodology you're using? And maybe you don't know because you've never asked the questions. Maybe the particular method you're using works real well in another situation, but will never work in your situation. And so my challenge to you is to take the worksheet, sit down with some other people in your situation, and whether you're talking about preparing leaders in your church or designing a program to prepare leaders for the country, the denomination, sit down with a group of people and go through these questions. And if you've got existing programs, ask the questions with those programs in mind. Do they fit the situation? Or ask the questions and then start thinking, okay, what is a program that will fit this situation? But don't design the program until you've got your mind full of the information that comes from this set of questions. Then it's going to flow naturally. And make sure it's more than just you. Make sure it's a room full of people. So, again, there's nothing sacred about this, but I think it provides useful categories. And, you know, if we had the time and the inclination and the motivation, we could probably come up with more categories or other questions. My intent here is just to get you started thinking and to realize that you need to analyze the situation that you're preparing leaders for. Questions? Comments? Yes, sir.
Just, I know these could be divided. I mean, could be among some of the ones you've already got, but I'm just thinking of some of the context, cultural context. I know you mentioned that under sociological, but that to me seems like a separate. Sometimes a psychological context, you know, when you're dealing with students and mindsets, particularly, you know, coming east and west and all those kinds of things, you know, can be factors that need to be examined separately.
Yeah, if I were to, just based upon what you've said, and even as I've thought about it, I've assumed an awful lot, or I've put an awful lot into the sociological category. A sociologist would probably take that category and have a new category of questions for every question I've got there. And that's, yeah, I think you're right. And unpacking the culture. Other comments? Yes, sir. Right.
You know, we have multiple ones. And that is the case in a lot of seminaries in North America, certainly in England. In my part of the world, I see some seminaries that way. And administrators struggle. Faculty members struggle because they want to make it relevant, but relevant to who?
Exactly. And see, there's two ways. I've heard two ways of answering that question. One is, okay, we exist to provide leadership preparation for this group of churches in this setting. If people from another setting want to come, fine, but they need to realize that. The other, and I think a better one in light of the global village that we are, is that because of where we are and who we are, we have resources that our brothers and sisters in other parts of the world don't have. Therefore, we have a responsibility to them, and therefore we have a responsibility to learn to contextualize what we're doing. At Bethel Seminary San Diego, we're one of three campuses of Bethel Seminary. There's the Midwest campus in St. Paul, then we have Seminary of the East. And our San Diego campus is the one that specializes in contextualization. We have the most diverse student body, and our faculty sit and think a lot about now that we've diversified the student body, we've got to diversify and contextualize the curriculum. And it's interesting, those of my faculty that have cross-cultural experience flow with that a lot easier than those that don't. And so one of the things I'm doing is trying to get faculty overseas into cross-cultural experiences. So, other comments, questions? Yes, sir.
Among these categories,
yes, 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 wow.
Social, theological, educational, economic, but who will teach?
Exactly, wow. And maybe I need to take the economic one and say resources. Economic resources, yeah, no, you're exactly right. You're exactly right. You're exactly right. That's, yeah, that's going to influence the program that you plan. Yeah, it is. Yeah, good point. Excellent point. Others? Don't keep your wisdom from us. We've gotten some good stuff here. Don't be selfish. Oh, we got to go eat too, don't we, Mark?
Yeah, 5 minutes.
I thought we were supposed to end at 4:15. Or 5:15.
5:30.
Oh, 5:30.
Yeah. It's 5:30.
Okay. Okay. Others? Other comments, questions? Well, that gives you a couple minutes. Do they need to fill these forms out for you before they leave?
Yeah, they can fill them out, and as they're exiting, give it to one of the people, because we actually have to exit.
And awful doesn't have an E. It's spelled with a U.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.